Hello, everybody. I'm John Modaff, sitting in for Chuck Meraz here on the front page on WMKY. Our guest today, Dr. Bernadette Barton, professor of sociology at Morehead State University. And she's here to discuss two of her publications, a book titled Pray the Gay Away, The Extraordinary Lives of Bible Belt Gays, which has received honors of distinction since its publication in 2012, and her earlier work, Stripped, Inside the Lives of Exotic Dancers, published in 2006, both from New York University Press. Professor Barton, welcome to the front page.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be on the front page.
Your title says it all, and really stunning. It's not for the faint of heart, though. I've got to say it was a difficult book to read.
Yes.
Because of the abominable behavior of people. I ended up being ashamed of people in some respects by the end of it. But before we talk about how you did this book, tell us a little bit about what you learned. That is, what did your respondents tell you about what happens to them as Bible Belt gays?
They had a lot of gory stories to share. So I'm not originally from Kentucky, but I moved here in 1992 to start graduate school at the University of Kentucky. And when I first came to Kentucky, I was actually identified as heterosexual. And then I came out in 1995. So I had a little bit of an outsider perspective. And I actually came from this perspective where I felt like homophobia was something of the past. I was somewhat naive in my experience of Kentucky. And then I had an experience that I write about in the book where a neighbor calls me an abomination after I came out to him. And that really motivated me to research, to talk to gay people who grew up here, who grew up in other areas of the Bible Belt, about what their lives were like, what they experienced, what it means just to grow up in an area where there is so much homophobia and that they experience it from a very young age.
And what were some of the, if there were any typical syndromes or patterns that you saw developing in the way that people were treated, either when they came out or just by being gay in the region?
Well, there were definitely some patterns, and one of the patterns that I observed was a lot of folks struggling with family rejection. And one definite pattern was that every single person that I interviewed experienced either being treated badly by their family of origin, that is worse than a heterosexual sibling, or when they were with a partner, the partner's family treating the relationship, the same-sex relationship, as inferior, if they were even out. So every single person, 100% of participants, including myself, experienced that, where there was like a secondary class status in the family, which is a very unusual thing to experience, being a minority group member in your own family. So there was a lot of family rejection, a lot of people who didn't want to come out to their family. So there was, I theorize about it, I call it the toxic closet, and I talk about it as a condition of inarticulation. So it took a lot for many of the people that I interviewed to come out to their families, and some still hadn't at the time of our interview. Mm-hmm. Another big pattern was 3/4 of interview subjects had gone to churches that were condemning of homosexuality in some way, shape, or form. So that also socialized Bible Belt gays, that there was something wrong and bad and about themselves that they should keep hidden. So those were two big things that I observed.
As you listen to the stories and accounts of the people that you talked to, the term homophobia became operational for you. You mm-hmm. saw it being manifest and played out.
Yes.
Is it fear entirely, or is there something else going on? I'm not sure fear quite covers it. I don't know. You've got a lot more experience with it than I do, I'm mm-hmm. sure, but people's behavior is motivated for lots of reasons, and fear is only one of them. Is that name big enough to describe, is that label, homophobia, big enough to describe the complex emotions these people are feeling?
Well, no label is perfect. We could also talk about heterosexism, which is this putting forth of a heterosexual relationship as natural and normal and the sort of only acceptable alternative. But arguably, fear was not the only thing that folks talked about. They also experienced being hated and being treated violently and being treated as though they were inferior for this singular characteristic.
Yeah. It's malice.
Malice is a good way to put it.
And of course, phobias can be malicious. People get angry when they get scared. But this other, some of the other things you're talking about there are interesting too. It is complicated. And it might be that there's more than one emotion driving some of the ways people were treated.
Well, if we wanted to explore the fear, there's a recent study out that demonstrates that people who express the most homophobic attitudes and behaviors tend to be those who are struggling with same-sex attractions, so that there's actually a link between those two things that was just empirically proven.
Yes, so possible...
possible internalized homophobia and fear of one's own attractions could be fueling a lot of the homophobic attitudes that we see.
Very interesting as a theory, because that person who you're concerned about or rejecting or kicking out or trying to pray the gay out of is close to you. And if the thing happened to them, the thing might happen to you too. And so if you're afraid of yourself, they're reminding you of something that you don't want to think about.
And that dynamic is probably a bit different in the family. So if it's a mom rejecting a gay child, I'm not sure that that internalized, like their own same-sex attraction that's up the moms is what's fueling that. Yeah. But I think that in the playground, in the high school cafeteria, the one who's the biggest bully towards gay kids is likely somebody who might be struggling with same-sex attractions.
And there's a way for them to fight it by fighting
right.
the other.
Exactly, by taking it out on the despised other.
Right. It's sad. It's dramatic. It's hard to put down. The courage of some of your subjects is remarkable. As you saw people reacting to the phobic behavior, to the malice, what were some of the stands that people took that you remember as they responded to their families or their rejection?
Well, there are so many stories. There was one story that I'm remembering of a young man who ended up coming out to his mother on Thanksgiving, and the family was coming over to eat, and she was so upset she broke all the plates on the floor and hid in the bathroom and didn't come out, and he had to literally and metaphorically sort of clean up the mess and then handle telling the family members that Thanksgiving wasn't happening at their house. So when it came to stories of families, there were a lot of sad stories. There were a lot of stories of children that were now, they might have been children when it happened, or they could have been young adults or teenagers, complying and trying to please their parents who were rejecting them. So my interview subjects, the people that I spoke with, were had a lot more to say about conservative Christians in general, people like Pat Robertson, for example. And they had a lot of like very well-argued ideas about the flaws in their particular paradigms.
Yes.
And what they demonstrated to me, what I really learned from my interview subjects, was the ability to go through all this difficult stuff, go through all this rejection from family, and still have a strong sense of self and still be in alignment with their sexual orientation and demonstrate integrity. I talk about it as character strengths and virtues, drawing on a psychological theory of sort of positive thinking and ways in which that adversity, you can use adversity to make you stronger. And in this case, I saw that over and over and over again, and that was very inspiring.
It looks like Christianity in this form is a culprit of sorts, as if the scripture and what people have done with it has led to this abominable treatment of gay people. But is it Christianity, or is it a way of thinking that just is manifest in Christianity? For example, many other nations have strict laws forbidding same-sex relationships of any kind. Is this bigger than the Bible Belt?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I think that my findings would be, you know, arguably representative of the experiences of individuals engaged or involved in any conservative fundamentalist religion, not necessarily Christianity, but also Islam or Orthodox Judaism. Mm-hmm. So yes, and or Mormonism, which, you know, some people consider Christian. So
is that a necessary ingredient in the phobia, in the malicious behavior, that there's a strong religious thread to it? Or are atheists also as malicious? Has that been looked into as far as you know?
As far as I know, homophobic attitudes are easily tied to fundamentalist religious belief systems, but they don't necessarily have to be tied. People can be homophobic and not be religious at all.
You've noted in this book and in the other book, which we'll turn to after the break, mm-hmm. that people use terms to insult each other that are referential to gays. Like they'll say that's faggy behavior or that's queer. Mm-hmm. And the cultural assumption is that if you allude to this group and you put someone in it, you've insulted them.
Right.
And I don't think that has anything to do with religion per se. And it's more of a habit of ins and outs, you know.
And it's about the politics of domination. So that's the way any majority group maintains its domination, maintains its superiority over minority groups, is to be able to stigmatize the minority groups with language that puts them down.
Will it ever happen, Dr. Barton, where being gay will be unremarkable? You talk about younger people seeming mm-hmm. less het up about all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Will it happen? Do you see it coming?
I do see it coming. In fact, I see it coming more quickly than I expected, and I'm really excited to see that. So yes, I think that it's already becoming somewhat less remarkable, and I think in the next 10 years, it will not be something that we probably would have the same conversation about.
We're visiting with Dr. Bernadette Barton here on the Front Page. I'm John Modef, sitting in for Chuck Meraz. We'll be back after the break.
There's a lot happening in our region. Keep connected and view a list of community events by visiting our website at wmky.org. Click on the events tab at the top of the page and be connected to plays, festivals, art exhibits, concerts, workshops, and other events in the region. See a list of full community activities with event descriptions and information, location map, and more. You can also submit your organization's information and let WMKY help promote your event or activity. Visit us online at wmky.org. And be connected with your community.
Welcome back to the Front Page. I'm John Modef, sitting in for Chuck Meraz, who's out managing the expansion of the appreciable world through radio. We're visiting with Dr. Bernadette Barton, professor of sociology at Morehead State University here in Morehead, Kentucky. Welcome, Dr. Barton.
Thank you.
And let's talk about the book that you published in 2006, Stripped: Inside the Lives of Exotic Dancers. I'm going to tell you, when I checked the soft cover copy of this book out, which I have right here, which has a silhouette of a woman who could be nude, standing mm-hmm. there with her hands on her hips in some very high heels, I got a kind of an unusual look from the clerk.
Oh.
Is it because I'm just so old, or is it because there's something seedy about this book? Is that possible that I could get a look just for that, just for even reading about stripping?
Well, there's definitely a stigma associated with doing sexuality research and people, especially research on sex workers. So there's people have a lot of preconceptions about the lives of sex workers and the work of sex workers, and mm-hmm. It's a sticky stigma, and it can even rub off when you're holding the book.
Right. Here you are, and I'm just reading it. You wrote it.
I wrote it.
I can't imagine
yes.
what you have gone through. You spent a better part of a decade
yes,
on this project.
I did.
If there's one word, I guess, for me that could sum up the predicament that you describe for the women in the sex business, I think you call it the sex business, don't you?
Sex industry.
Sex industry. I like that even better. That one word would be stigma, as you've mm-hmm. already used today. What are the stigma or the stigmata, as it were, of stripping?
Well, and things have changed since I published that book in 2006. And in fact, I actually have just been in contact with my editor, and we're talking about doing a 10th anniversary edition of it. And I'm going to be collecting some more data. I have a great student working with me on this project. So the stigma, things have changed since 2006 to the extent that stripping or ideas about stripping have entered into mainstream culture. Think about pole dance classes. Think about how many music videos include exotic dancers, references to strippers in conversation. But yet, and we also have, so we've got a culture that's become more sexualized. I call it raunch culture. We've got a culture that's become more pornified. There's more like influences from pornography entering into mainstream media culture. We've got more hookup sex going on among young people. And then we've got the internet, technology, cell phones, all that has changed. So the experience of exotic dancing today is different than it was when I did my data gathering. Preliminary findings suggest that conditions have deteriorated even since when I gathered my data. But so the stigma is, if you're someone who sells sex in some form or other, there's something wrong with you. You're a bad person.
And what are some of the marks that are left by this? And we'll get into the process, because you do talk about stages, and some of them, there might be some greatly positive things for some of the women who work. But what are some of the long-term marks that are left by the life?
Well, I interviewed women about what they liked and what they didn't like about working as an exotic dancer. And the things that were difficult that they didn't like while they were working had to do with dealing with rude customers, dealing with a reduced sex drive, struggling to maintain a partnership because partners could be jealous, just feeling out of alignment with the work, sometimes the hours, the cigarette smoke, the toll on your body. It's hard to, you know, the dancing can be physically laborious, and you're moving your body pretty intensely for a couple of minutes, and then you're stopping, so it's sort of not a long, you know, cool down period. So all that can be taxing. But really what was the most troubling and the most disturbing was not anything that happened in the club, but dealing with other people's prejudicial attitudes and other people feeling like someone who works as a dancer is a bad person, and not being able to maybe tell their moms about their jobs, you know, keeping that hidden, being closeted about their work was challenging. And then not even be able to talk to friends about it. So that was much worse for the women that I interviewed than anything that actually happened in the club.
And for some of them, as I recall reading, this persistent cognitive dissonance and this hiding, shielding themselves against the presumptions of people, wore them out psychologically and made them ill, physically ill.
Yes, and I write about this. I talk about it as the toll. That working as an exotic dancer takes a toll, and it happens over time. It gets harder and harder over time.
If you don't mind, let's talk about your method a little bit, because you manage, I don't know how you do it, to get people to disclose and to talk about intensely personal things, and they're strangers. You must have a way to get access, to establish a research partnership or relationship, and to maintain that. What are some of your, or why do you think you're good at that? How is it that you got good at that? What skills do you have to exercise to maintain and pull that off?
Well, you're talking about my skill as an interviewer, I believe. And I am a very good interviewer. It's easy for me to establish rapport. I'm genuinely curious about people's, you know, things that they want to share. I'm probably somewhat of a nosy person. I'm not afraid to ask the questions, and I'm also non-judgmental, and I think all those things add up to allowing this conversation to really quickly evolve into something meaningful.
But you have a sharp tongue in your books, a time or two.
You think?
Yes. At the start of Stripped, you notice that there really are these two extreme treatments, that the stripper, their predicament is considered something that empowers them, allows them to control men and to get resources from men, and that's a good thing. On the other extreme, it's treated as debasing to women.
Well, I think the reason I was able to do that, and I'm able to continue to do that, is because I see something valuable in both perspectives. So the sex radical feminist perspective, that it's my body, I get to pick, and if I want to be sex worker, I should be able to, I agree with. And then the radical feminist perspective, that working in the sex industry, you know, contributes to a patriarchal social system that keeps all women oppressed, I also agree with that. So I find both perspectives valuable. And rather than being at war with each other, I think they are both projects that can advance simultaneously.
All right. And so you move from an either-or perspective. It's either debasing or empowering, to a both-and perspective.
Yes, it's both of those at the same time, potentially.
How do you control for your what might be called prior assumptions, what some call a priori assumptions, mm-hmm. that you carry in to the setting. You must be aware of them. Mm-hmm. They're even valued as data. You know, if you write down what you think, that is also narrative, and that's important. But it might influence who you talk to and what you let them say. How do you check for that to make sure that you're not letting them speak your rhetoric just by transcribing and excerpting creatively?
That's a good question, and certainly it's something that every researcher faces, that this bias in the research design itself and the kinds of questions that you want to ask. So one thing that I do is I always try to be attentive to my bias and to own it and to be aware of it and to just be very careful when I ask a question that the question is not colored by an assumption about what I expect to find. And I'm always teaching my students to do that too, that when you frame your questions, you know, say it's a question about video game usage. You don't want to say, how are video games bad for you? It would be more like, so what do you think about video game usage among young people? Mm-hmm. So that you don't automatically go in assuming that the person you're talking with is going to think they're bad.
Right.
So.
And you respect them by not judging them. And I guess they get more comfortable with you over time and they'll be more candid as mm-hmm. time goes on because they can trust you.
And usually this happens within a period of an hour to 2 hours. So, and most of my interviews for Stripped were one interview with one person that happened over about an hour and a half period. Pray the Gay was a little bit different in the sense that because I'm a member of the community I was studying, I ended up interviewing people that I knew and that I continue to see. So that's very different. Whereas with the book, with Stripped, I'm not in contact really with the people that I interviewed, whereas with Pray the Gay Away, I sometimes see some of those folks. Mm-hmm. So that has its own sort of sticky issues, you know, mm-hmm. with confidentiality and so
yes.
forth.
There is so much more that I want to ask you about both of these books. And also, I think we could do an entire program on some of the phrases that have come up today. I really am interested in this concept of the male gaze.
And for anyone who's confused, when he says gaze, he means gaze as in looking, G-A-Z-E.
Right, the male gaze, G-A-Z-E. I'm so glad you said that. But it's just a thing that I don't certainly want to even begin to defend men. I'm not proud of my species or my side of it. But at the same time, that's something that needs a good hard look at, because if things can change, maybe they are. And we may need some new language. I don't know. But we could talk about that another time. What I would love to hear from you before you go is what's next?
Well, actually, so I'm in conversation with my editor about two different projects. One of them is this 10th anniversary edition of Stripped, in which I'm going to collect new data and update the book. And the other project that I'm working on is interviewing women about their best sexual experiences. And what I'd like to do is sort of compile these as a guide for young people about what good sex looks like, because we live in this pornified culture right now that's driving me crazy, and I'd like to give some tools.
That raises the question, what is good? Which will be an interesting chapter, I'm sure.
Well, I'm going to let my interview subject share what they think.
Go. Well, I wish you the best of luck with those projects,
well,
and
thank you
so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
I'm John Modaf, here sitting in for Chuck Mraz on the Front Page. Our guest has been Professor Bernadette Barton, Professor of Sociology at Morehead State University. Thank you for listening.